Okay, so for those of you who don't know me, my name is Joel Padowitz. My plan, my hope is to go through Mishabura cover to cover with all of you, or even more of you, as Hashem. And we'll try to do all the Mishaburas inside. I'm going to assume that no one knows anything, but that you're all very smart. And that way, we'll do every word inside, I'll translate everything, that way at least everyone's on a level playing field. But I won't belabor any point, I'll try not to repeat myself or drag any feet, and then if something's not clear, you can just ask me. Now, today I don't think we'll actually see anything inside, I'll give a Hakdama. I'm a big believer in Hakdamas, introductions, so we'll expect an introduction tonight. I think it's only fair if we're going to dedicate 2 or 3 years learning a Sefer, we ought to talk about the genesis of it a little bit. But in general, just as a principle for the whole Shir, the Mishabura speaks at length, he's a posek, he's meant to be practical. I think what will be very bad for the Shir is if people ask what-if questions, at least during the Shir. There'll be an email listserv, you can send me whatever you want, I'll look into it. But if people start asking the what-if questions, not a clarifying of what the Mishabura is saying, but other applications, then like it will just spiral out of control. That's my anticipation. And if we want to finish in a reasonable amount of time, the name of the game is going to be focused on what the Mishabura is saying, understanding his words. That'll be my agenda, to understand what he's saying. Okay. So for tonight, I want to just do an introduction, and I'll start from the very beginning and get to the very end, which is Torah's given at Sinai, and end up at what the Mishabura is attempting to do. So everyone knows Torah's given at Sinai, and it remained oral until the first time it was written down is about the year 200 of the Common Era, when Rabbi Yehuda Nasi decided that the times were too tough under Roman persecution, and if we don't write something down, then the Torah Sheba Al Peh, which is oral, will be lost. So despite Chazal's prohibition of writing Torah down, he chose to do so, and he had his own heter for doing so. He said it's an eis lasos, he had to do it, the times demanded it. Rashi, in Bava Metzia, Daf Lamed Gimel, and I have notes here, I probably read them tonight, but I didn't print them up because they're 17 pages long for this summary, but I'll email them to you so you'll get them over there, so you don't have to bother writing this down. But Rashi in Bava Metzia explains that at the time of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, at the end of the 2nd century, that he, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, had a good relationship with Antoninus, which is said to be Marcus Aurelius, the Roman authorities at the time, and the Jews had a bit of a respite in the end of the 2nd century, and he said this is our big chance to write to, when we have some Menuchas and Nefesh, to codify something, and the Jews were allowed to assemble, and the leading authorities, as Rashi explains in Bava Metzia, the leading Tanaim of his time got together and codified a full set of their Masorah. Every upset time, no one had written anything down, but that means publicly. But privately, each and every Tana had his own private notes. They compared notes and discussed and came to some sort of a consensus agreement on how the halacha should go. Rebbe wrote the Mishnah. You're familiar with the Mishnah as a text. So he codified and he put the dissenting opinions where need be. And it stayed like that for, let's call it 200 years. Now, before the time of the Mishnah, there was no need for any codification because you had a Sanhedrin operating. With a Sanhedrin, if you have a question, it just goes as a series of courts, so smaller courts and regional courts, and then larger 23-man courts, all the way up to the Sanhedrin of Gadol, 70-person courts, and everything could be resolved. When the Sanhedrin found it hard to preside properly, they had to codify something. But the Sanhedrin continued to the year 358 of the Common Era, into the 4th century. At that time, basically, it was the end, that's the last time Sanhedrin met. They did some things like sanctify the new moon from then until Yemos Mashiach, for example. And they also, about that time, also finished the Talmud Yerushalmi, which is back on the shelves after a long hiatus. But the Chazal from the 3rd century shifted, in the time of Rebbe Yehuda Nasi, it was in Eretz Yisrael, but the balance of power shifted to Bavel. When Rav left, Rav was the last of the Tanaim, or the first of the Amoraim, when he left to Bavel, so basically they set up yeshivas over there, and Bavel, Babylonia, Iraq, became the leading Torah center. And they, in the 5th century, early 5th century, said the Mishnah is too terse, it's too, not enough words there, and there's too much open for dispute, and too much non-clarity has erupted, because things have gone worse, not better, and we need to further explicate and clarify the halachas as presented in the Mishnah. So, the sages of that time, we call them the Amoraim, the people primarily in Bavel, but there was communication back and forth. Rabbi Yochanan, for example, was leader of Jewry back in Eretz Yisrael, and you see in the Gemara, you know, Rav Dimi, and so people running back and forth, relating Rabbi Yochanan's halachas, but in any case, those, in the 4th century, they decided to put together a much more comprehensive explication of the whole Torah Shabbat Peh, which would supplant not only the just the Mishnah by itself, but also the Talmud Yerushalmi, which basically fell to the wayside, essentially, which became the Talmud Bavli. Talmud Bavli was closed at the very end of the 5th century, 499 perhaps is the date. That's with Ravina and Ravashi. They were the last of the Amoraim, and with that closed the Talmud. Just the same way that the Amoraim felt they couldn't dispute the Tanaim, they held the Tanaim were the canon. They didn't feel they could. The Amoraim didn't feel they could come up with new opinions that weren't backed by pre-existing Tanaitic opinions. So too, after the Amoraim, at the closing of the Talmud at the end of Ravina and Ravashi, say the year called 500, roughly, subsequent generations did not feel they had the authority to dispute, and it's clear they didn't dispute the Talmud. If they all went to explain what the Talmud was saying, but the Talmud's collection of halachas and explanations of the halachas, the Jewish people accepted as being a comprehensive and authoritative presentation of Torah Shabbat Peh. So that's where it stood. For the next roughly 80 years, there was another generation of people you hear nothing about, really, called Rabbanim Savarai, who basically, 90 years actually, I guess, to the year 589, they attempted to edit and slightly modify and finalize, clarify the Talmud as a text. You don't hear about them, they're not really, none of them are famous as far as I know, but by the end of the, like say 589, you have a finished Talmud. After that, everyone felt this is how it should stay, and we shouldn't add any more formal texts. And for a long time, from say the year 589, when the Talmud was like really finished with the Rabbanan Savarai, all the way to the year 1038, you're talking now, you know, almost 700 years, there was a period called the Gaonim, and during the period of the Gaonim, there was no more formal texts really written out of the Talmud and the other existing, you know, Tanaic texts. If people had questions, they would send their questions from wherever they were, far flung around the world, to the Gaonim, who were a Gaon is a technical term. It was the head of the leading yeshiva. It could be Sura, it could be Pamadisa, it depended, but the leading sage of his day. It's called the Gaon, and he would resolve any questions in the form of what in English is translated as responsa literature. I think responsa is actually pretty much a made-up word like phylacteries. I don't think it's like a word to itself. But anyways, Shalos and Tshuvas is useful as tefillin is useful. Shalos and Tshuvas, they would send shaylot, questions, and they would be asked with tshuvos, answers, like in letter form. So what happened is there's a massive literature over centuries of particular questions and the answers. Some are very, very simple, and the tshuvas are not innovative at all. They're just, you know, it's black and white. And many are like what you would think today's shaylos and tshuvas are. We have a new situation, how should we rule? And the gaon of that time would answer. And the literature built up as like letters, question and answer, shaylos and tshuvas. Now, around the year, beginning of the 11th century, things were out of hand. The stability they had in Bavel fell apart. The Muslims were very difficult in Bavel. Things were tough. It was also depressed in Bavel. And the Jews basically ran away from Babylonia and spread Europewards in the 11th century. And no one had the time, or the headspace, as the Rambam puts it, to dedicate themselves to really understand the Talmud. And without the centers of learning that like they had in Bavel, so they needed some buddy, they felt, to clarify the Talmud and understand how to learn the Talmud. So the first real player in this is known as the Rif. This is Rav Yitzhak of Fez. Rif stands for Yitzhak of Fez. He, born in the year 1013, I believe, born in Algeria, but moved to Spain, and he'd set up shop in Spain, where many leading Rishonim ended up. He attempted to sort of, let's call it, condense the Talmud by cutting out in his Sefer Halachos all of the all the parts of the Talmud which you didn't need to get to the bottom line halacha. So he just basically chopped Talmud, cut and pasted, if you will, pasting all the relevant sections and cutting out all the irrelevant sections. When I say relevant, irrelevant, I mean relevant in terms of deciding the bottom line halacha. He did also add his own commentary a little bit to it. It's minimal, and he also incorporated some stuff from other Gaonim. Right, but he is really, we can call him, arguably, the first of the Rishonim, or the last of the, we'll call him the first of the Rishonim. The last of the Gaonim is typically called Rav Hai Gaon, 1038 he died, and the Rif is more or less the first of the Rishonim. He was in Spain, after he fled Algeria. His contemporary really is Rashi. Rashi was born in 1040, a few years younger. Rashi operated out of France, essentially, and they didn't know each other. And Rashi took a different approach. And Rashi started a different school over there, following after his teacher. But yeah, they're Masoras, but they took a different approach. But the Rif was the first to attempt to give a halachic bottom line of the Talmud. The Rif. Keep that in mind. And it's, the Rif's on every Gemara in the background. Back in France, they took a different approach. Rashi didn't attempt to bottom line anything. He just, as you know, Rashi did, he made a running commentary along the Talmud, and his grandson, the Rebbeinu Tam, was the leading of the founders of a new school, the Balei Tosfos, Tosfos and Editions, that added, you know what Tosfos do, to the Talmud, and it was halachic in nature, but it was not to bottom line each sugya as it went. It was to pick and choose issues that were problematic. They disagreed with Rashi. Later, Balei Tosfos tried to reconcile the tradition in Provence and so on in France with what was going on in Spain and so on, but it wasn't halachic in nature, really. It wasn't bottom line halachic in nature. The Rif was sort of stood alone. He was the king. The Rif had a student, his name was the Rimi Gash, not important to remember that name really, who had a student named Rabbi Maimon, who had a son named Moshe, who is known to us as Ramosha ben Maimon, the Rambam. And the Rambam felt that the Rif and the Talmud and all the other side texts, Tanaitic texts, you know, you have Mishnah and you have Sifra and Sifri and you have all sorts of small Masechtas, and there's a Yerushalmi floating around, there's stuff that this wasn't quite mentioned clearly, whatever it was. He felt the whole thing is impossible to navigate for regular people, and he said he was the last of the irregular people, the extraordinary people who could handle it. And he said he is going to clarify the halacha, but he took a different approach. The Rif didn't tamper with the structure of the Talmud. He just condensed it, cutting out the stuff that shouldn't distract you. The Rambam, who could be said it was Aristotelian in nature, was a philosopher for sure, he decided to restructure the whole corpus of Jewish law and do it totally abstractly, to say how, start with principles and then their rational, natural consequence, if you will. So you read the Rambam, it's a, like a philosophical work. It's not a practical work per se. It teaches you the principles behind the law, because then the principles lead to other applications. But the Rambam is dense. It's both his commentary on the Talmud as well as his instructions of what to do. And the Rambam basically took the whole Torah. He called his book the Mishnah Torah. That's of course a reference to the repetition of the Torah. He felt he encapsulated it all. He claims in the introduction that he didn't deviate from the Rif at all, except in a few places. That's what he says. It's not exactly true. He didn't deviate from the Rif. The Rif really is his. The Rambam calls the Rimi Gash, who's the Rif's student, he refers to him as his Rebbe in a few places. Rimi Gash died when the Rambam was 6, so he didn't learn from him directly. He learned from through his father. And he had no contact with the Rif. Be that as it may, the Rambam and the Rif largely see eye to eye. That's important to know in a minute. You'll see. He claims he didn't dispute him at all. It's not exactly true. You'll find lots of places the Rambam is mighty innovative. But in any case, the Rambam is their second attempt to codify the whole corpus of Jewish law and a different structure than the Rif. Fine. Back in France, they had their own approach to doing things, and someone stood up, a German scholar, was known as the Rush, Rabbi Usher. He was a student of the Maharam of Rottenberg. He was the leader of German Jewry at the time. Germany and France had different borders. It was essentially the same region. When the Maharam was held hostage and ransomed, I've actually been to Rottenberg and I've seen where they kept him there. So it's interesting as a side point. They asked a lot of money from the community, and the community was prepared to pay, and the Maharam said, no, you're not overpaying my ransom. You let me die in prison. We will not negotiate with terrorists. That was his position. And the Maharam died in prison. His students, what we call the Rush, Ben Asher, he fled to Spain, eventually becoming a rabbi in Toledo. But he was really we'll call him an Ashkenazi rabbi from the beginning. So the Rush followed the Rif's style, and he went doing the same kind of thing that the Rif did. He's later. The Rush lives, born in 1250, so he's much later. He's like 150 years later, roughly speaking. 150 years later than them. He again attempts to codify the halachas, but he incorporates the rulings of the Balei Tosfos and the school in Provence. In fact, if you learn Gemara, there's the Tosfos on the page. Many times, you want to clarify what Tosfos is saying, you look at what's called Tosfos Harush, which is his version, often word for word exactly his comment or whatever, his codification of the Tosafot. The additions to the Talmud are the word for word or slightly different, and you can understand what Tosfos, like say Rabbeinu Tam, wherever it is on the page of the Gemara, what he meant by seeing exactly how the Rush speaks out a little bit different or a little bit more fully. He was one of the Balei Tosfos. He wrote his own set of halachas called the Rush today to us, Piskei Rush. in the same kind of style as the riff, going piece like section by section, sugya by sugya through the Gemara, but incorporating not just his opinion, but the discussion a little bit about the Dvalitosis and a little bit about what was going on around him and even in Spain a little bit. So you have three major attempts to codify the whole of Jewish law. There were other attempts that were less significant, but these are the ones that are relevant for us. The Rif, who's the first, the Rambam, who really sees eye to eye with him, basically, and the Rosh, who really is from, not from Spain, like those two were, but from, started out anyways, in Ashkenaz, Germany. Fine. The Rosh had a son, whose name was the Tur, born in 1275. Sorry, his name was Yaakov, yes. Yaakov, but he wrote a sefer called the Arba Turim, literally, known to us as the Tur. So, the Tur felt that this is all very nice, but there are all these major attempts and all these minor attempts to codify halacha, and things have gone totally out of hand. Because sometimes you have two or three or five or 10 different ways to learn a sugya. Like, how are you going to, you know, I mentioned like the halachas, but you've also got a Rajba floating around, you've got a Ramban floating around. You have like, you know, so many Rishonim at this point floating around by the second half of, you know, getting to the late 13th century, that he felt this is out of control, and we have to sort of make a compendium that puts it all back together again. So he attempted, and this is the first time anyone did this. Up to now, before the Tur, everyone did their own take. Everyone, the Rambam did his understanding, the Rif did his understanding, and the Balach and Gedolz did his understanding. Everyone did their own understanding. The Rush a little bit incorporated his school of thought, but he was really on his own. The Tur attempts to bring things together, and he, like the Rambam, decides to restructure the whole way in which halacha is organized. He does something very different than the Rambam, though. His structure is different. But while the Rambam was, I'll call it like a philosophical work, he wanted to give you like sort of an abstract and sort of well-structured way to approach the whole Torah. So the Rambam incorporates philosophical ideas and ethical ideas. He's got a whole system going on. The Rambam has the Torah, the whole system. The Tur is much less ambitious. He said this is going to be a practical work, and therefore it's going to incorporate other people's opinions, what can be bottom line, what to do. And also, we're not going to discuss all sorts of things, abstract philosophy, what goes on the base of Mikdash, the mitzvahs you do in Eretz Yisrael, leaving all that out, because that's not relevant for us. We've been in Gullus for 1,000 years, it should end soon, said he, but until then, we need to like focus on what we need to do. So he was merakeh, he focused, he concentrated and localized all the different issues, and he restructured the whole of Torah into four different turim. Tur is like a column, a pillar. So the four columns, the four turim. The first is Orachaim, which means, I don't know, I won't translate them, the reference doesn't matter. Orachaim discusses the Jewish daily life, and also weekly life, and monthly life, and yearly life. The holidays, prayer, what you do when you go, how to go to the bathroom, how to get dressed, how to deal with your Pesach Seder. That's the first section, the Orachaim, which is all, actually jumping ahead for a second, Mishabura is only focused on that piece. Okay, that's only that piece. There are three other pieces. He also made what's called Yoredeya, separate section. Forget the translation, it doesn't translate properly. But Yoredeya deals with what I call ritual law. He deals with kashrus, nida, ribbis, which is something that is considered ritual law. But he deals with, you know, ritual law. Yeah. Then he has another section, Evena Ezer, which is basically marital law, Gittin, Kedushin, Yevamos. And finally, Choshen Mishpat, which is financial laws, nezikin, you know, damages, torts, financial obligations, loans, etc. So property rights. So that is the four sections that he divided it into: Arba Turim, Orachaim, which is our topic, daily life; Yoredeya, ritual law; Evenezer, or Choshen Mishpat; Evenezer, marital law; and Choshen Mishpat, financial and interpersonal and civil law. That's what I wanted. Civil law. Fine. And he collected them. He collected different opinions. The problem was, that went on for a while, very nice. The problem was, he didn't have all the manuscripts, because it was, remember, before, in that age, it was before the printing press still, so books were hard to come by. He didn't get all the books, but he attempted to sort of collect and consolidate. He missed things, and certainly he died still in the 14th century. There was more that came after him. So things, although what he intended to achieve wasn't exactly achieved. More and other people came along, and the Tur's attempt to be comprehensive, but just not comprehensive. So, the Jewish world clearly saw that the Tur was a good idea, but it needed to be sort of revamped for the, you know, 150 years had passed, 100 years had passed, or 50 years had passed. So two men simultaneously, unbeknownst to one another, had the same exact idea. We're going to essentially address the tour and make it more practical. One is Rabbi Yosef Caro. Yosef Caro, born in 1488 in Spain. He was 4 years later chased out of Spain during the Inquisition. And he ended up in Sfat with about 200 other superstar Rabbanim, but they put him as the head of the pack. He was the rabbi of this sort of elite cadre of Rabbanim and Sfat that were around there in the 15th century, 16th century really, early 16th century. And he first wrote, his first major work was the Kesef Mishnah. The Kesef Mishnah is a running commentary on the Rambam. The Rambam, for whatever reasons, decided not to put any sources as his work. He wanted to be super condensed. He didn't make any footnotes at all. No citations at all. Even the Rambam seems to have regretted it and wanted to later on do another book that would have the footnotes, you know, to his Rambam. He never got around to it. The Mishnah Torah. He never got around to it. So the Kesef Mishnah, remember, the Rambam is an attempt to codify all of the whole of the Torah Shavuot Peh. So the Kesef Mishnah went through, that's the Brevios of Karo, and went through every line of the Rambam essentially, and tried to give the source of where he got his halacha from. So essentially he went through the whole of Torah Shavuot Peh, everything, and lined it up with the Rambam. That was very nice, but it wasn't practical because the Rambam is just the Rambam and there are other players. So after he finished that entire work, it's a monumental work, a life work of a superstar, he then attacked the same approach to the tour. He went to the tour, and he said the tour needs to be sort of revamped to deal with what's happened since the tour, what he left out, and to clarify when customs didn't necessarily follow the tour, said what is the bottom line. So the Beis Yosef, that's what he's called in this work, Yosef Karo wrote the Kesef Mishnah on the Rambam, he wrote what's called the Beis Yosef on the tour. He went through every halacha in the tour, same thing, where he got that halacha from back in the Talmud, all the way down, discussing the different Rishonim and how they thought it out, and how the Torah got his idea. But the Beis Yosef bottom lines it. The Beis Yosef says, and this is what you should do, practically speaking, bottom line. So he codified everything. Massive. The Beis Yosef is the greatest halachic work in terms of practical halacha. You can ignore the Rambam for a second, because this is categorized on itself, that was ever done. And it remains the foundation of all halacha, Ari Yom Hazeh. No responsible Rav would attempt to poskin things that's knowing the Beis Yosef first. That's where it starts from. He collects everything and moves it through to the bottom line. That's great. So if you want to be a serious posek, you learn the Torah of Beis Yosef. And his time went on for a long time like that. The only problem was Beis Yosef. Good, if you want to be a superstar posek, you can learn the Beis Yosef. But the Beis Yosef is massive. The Torah Beis Yosef is actually on the shelves today. You look at them, where are they? Over there, right? It's bigger than the Shas. It's massive, massive work. So, much bigger than the Shas, actually. So it's not practical. So the Beis Yosef himself, Rav Yosef Karo said, you know, how many times in your life can you possibly review through my work and you're going to forget the details? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to make a condensed version of the Beis Yosef. Just bottom line, the Beis Yosef. In a separate work, which would be like a prefab set table, Shulchan Aruch, a set table, which will just summarize so you can remember the whole massive Beis Yosef. And in his own lifetime, a version of the Shulchan Aruch was printed, which divided the whole of Shulchan Aruch into 30 days, so you can chazar it every month. That was his idea. This will be your chazara of halacha, l'maisa bottom line, to chazar the Shulchan Aruch. That's what he did. Which you got to the Shulchan Aruch, it's based on the structure, it's based on the summary, bottom line of the Beis Yosef, structured based on the Torah. That was him in Spain, in Sfat, really, in Eretzro. At the same time, a man in Krakow, who was the leader of Eastern European Jewry, or Central, Polish people today get very irritated, we call Poland Eastern Europe, Central Europe, whatever. Most of Jewry at that point was in Poland, what we call Poland. The majority of, you don't realize this, in the golden age of Polish Jewry, the majority of all the world's Jews were actually in Poland, including the Sephardim. Right, there were about a million. 17th century, there were like a million Jews worldwide. But anyways, something like that. In any case, so the leader, the greatest rabbi of his time and age, and this time we're talking now also, he was, I think, born, no one knows, like 1520, 1530, so he's a little younger than the Beis Yosef. He did the same idea. He wrote a commentary called the Darchei Moshe, like the Beis Yosef is on the tour, the Darchei Moshe is on the tour. The same. And then again, wanted to bottom line it and summarize it. The problem is, as the story goes, Beis Yosef was learning, he had other things too besides write the Beis Yosef. He learned with an angel. Interesting, but he actually there's a sefer written that he wrote of questions he asked the angel told him when he was sleeping at night, titled like that. Doesn't have any halachic significance, But there you go. I don't know how it makes you feel. The greatest, you know, juror of all Jewish history learned with angels in light, but that's what he did. In any case, so story has that the angel told him, you know what? There's some guy in Poland who's going to beat you to the punch. You better get out your book first. And that's what happened. So Beis Hillel published his work first. One of the the Ramosh Islis is known to us as the Ramah. So one of the Ramah's students started him doing a big favor then crack on. Look what a great book I have to bring you. Here is the Beis Hillel of Shulchan Aruch, a work on the tour. You'd be so happy to have it. And he's interesting. If you read the Ramah's Hakdama, he says, like, you know, for weeks he walked around, he couldn't think, he couldn't eat, because, like, his life was ruined. He spent however many years, 20 years, whatever, working on this work, which someone else did already ahead of him, and he was destroyed. But then, interestingly enough, he says, upon review, he sees that the work that the Beis Yosef did actually doesn't incorporate the real-life approach that Ashkenazi Jewry has taken on for themselves. In the world, the Jewish world, they really essentially split into Ashkenazi and Sephardic Jewry, and the customs were very different. So he ended up saying that rather than, you can't, you know, beat him, join him, he will find a way to make the Shulchan Aruch, as the Beis Yosef, the Rabbi Yosef Karo, put it together, be usable not just for Sephardic Jewry, but for all of world Jewry, including Ashkenazi. So what he did is he wrote his just the same way that the Beis Yosef had a summary version called the Shulchan Aruch. The Darche Moshe, the big work on the tour, had a condensed version that he called the Mapa. Now the Mapa means a tablecloth. It's a pun on the Shulchan Aruch has a set table, and the Mapa is a tablecloth to go on top to complete it. Now, some of the differences are a matter of custom, but there's something much more fundamental going on, which is interesting, this is how it is. The way in which these two poskim, who we follow today, took to bottom lining the halacha was very different. As far as the Beis Yosef was concerned, Yosef Karo, he said, listen, who am I to decide who's right or wrong between the Rush and the Rambam? I can't. I'm only me. So he said, listen, the principle we see already from the Chumash tells you, Achir Rab Lahatos, when you have a Sanhedrin and dissenting opinions, you go out, majority rules, majority of the sages rule. So he said, listen, the three biggest codifiers, he said, in his Hagdama, the Beis Yosef says, I've considered like 20 odd different people who codified halacha, but he said there are three obvious people that stand out from the crowd: the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rosh. So he said, I'm going to now, basically my policy will be best two out of three. So he says, if all three agree, the Rif, the Rosh, and the Rambam agree, so then it's a no-brainer, we go like that. If it's two against one, then I still will go with the majority over the minority, and that's what he does. He's like afraid of the Rambam, that's my word, but you see, the Rambam carried more weight in his eyes than other two, and therefore when the Rambam is the dissenting opinion, he almost invariably can't resist but say V'yesh Omrim, there's another opinion that says not like this. He couldn't swallow leaving the Rambam out, interestingly enough. In any case, but he also put the caveat, he says sometimes if it's two out of three and everyone subsequent to these three backed the minority opinion or said differently, I will go with them anyway. So the rule didn't exactly hold fast all the time. And sometimes he says when one of the three didn't give an opinion, there were some questions, only say two out of the three ever wrote about it, then he'll rely on, and they disagree. So let's say the Rush and the Rambam disagree. So what's he going to do? He says, I'll rely on the other big guns, the Rajba, the Ramban, and so on. So bottom line is, he, as a general rule, followed those big three, best two out of three, as a general rule. The Ramah took a different approach. He said, as much of Ashkenazi Jewry didn't like that idea very much, like the Rabbanon. I thought that's no way to, up until this time, you ask the rabbi, he decides for himself and gives you a psak. You know, two out of three is no way, that's not called hora, that's not called patsin, that's just like kachraz, compromise, that's not how we do halacha. So he took a different approach. The Ramah took an interesting approach, which he thought was the way to go, which is the Chazal themselves say that from the time of Ravina and Ravashi, pretty much the latest of the Amoraim, the halacha goes after the Basrai, the last of the authorities. The thinking, the rationale is, Ravina and Ravashi, I'm talking about the Gemara now, they saw all the Amoraim before them, and they considered them, they took them into consideration. So if they said what they said, if they disagree with the people who came before them, they took them into consideration and they held they were wrong. So the Ramah said, we're going to also take that same approach. I mean, he was working independent of the Machaber, of the Beis Yosef, of the Rabbi Yosef Karo, lots of names, the same person. He said, I'm going to rely on the latest great authorities to decide what the way to go is, because they saw all the Rishonim and they poskim. So he takes two people which are only famous, really, in as much as that they are the backbone of the Ramah, two other halachas. One is called the Trumas Adeshen, and one is, which is quoted in the Rama, came out every other page, and the Maharil, both 15th century poskim, who like the Rama didn't even consider like relevant to the discussion essentially. So what happens is they have two totally different approaches to what the halacha is. Hence, you might have noticed Sfarim and Ashkenazim have very divergent ways of dealing with halacha because they took two radically different approaches to how to actually bottom line it. So obviously much commonality, but much difference. So then you have a Shulchan Aruch, same structure, the Torah in the four sections, the Or HaChaim, Yerodea, Kosh Mishpat, Evan Ezer, and you've got, the way it's structured is with the Mechaber, it's called the author, that's Rabbi Yosef Karo, and the Rama, his commentaries, glosses, in English these were glosses, but nowhere else, I don't think ever, these glosses, maybe in some legal texts, his, you know, emendations put side by side, they work together, that's the Shulchan Aruch. Now, remember, as far as the Mechaber is concerned, the Shulchan Aruch was not meant to be a practical book. This is like a bit of an important point. Although the Shulchan Aruch is the, we can call it the most authoritative halakhic work, and it's the most comprehensive as much as they consider everything and like bottom lined it, when Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote it, he didn't intend people to look at the Shulchan Aruch and Paskin. He intended people to know the Beis Yosef, which deals with the topic thoroughly, and then just like, you know, understand from this like one line at the end how the whole thing bottom lines. But it's not a practical work. So what people then, the literature exploded, if you, the notes they kill them, they're called, that are on the Shulchan Aruch list, Shachs and Taz and Avrams, you know, there's a whole world from the 17th and 18th century, that's what everyone was bothered with, being commentaries to re-explicate what the Shulchan Aruch did. In the 19th century, the world Jewry felt this was again unwieldy, so no, you have the Shulchan Aruch is supposed to be short, but then you have all these reams of commentaries and disputes all over again. There are a few different attempts to try to make it really practical. Famous amongst them is a 9th century work by Shlomo Gottfried, which is called the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, which people use today, which was the most popular Jewish book in the world at this time. Everyone had a copy, and it was practical and super cadet. There's another book that was similar in Ashkenazi world called Chai Adam, and there was the Aruch HaShulchan. There were different attempts, but for whatever reasons, the winner who stood out and his book took it was the Mishnah Berurah. The Mishnah Berurah is written by the Chafetz Chaim, as it's called. It wasn't his real name. His name was Yisrael Meir Kagan, but it was just Meir Kagan. But he's called the Chafetz Chaim because of a previous book he wrote about Lashon Hara. Not relevant. He was born in Russia and he died in Poland at the ripe old age of 90 something, 95, 96, whatever it was, no one knows exactly, I don't think. Sorry? 94 and a half? 94 and a half? So he's often given from 1838 to 1933. So I put him 94 and a half. In any case, he spent 25 years writing the Mishnah Berurah. And his attempt was to make the Shulchan Aruch, at least Or HaChaim section, practical all over again. That was his plan. But he attempted wherever possible to take what I'll call the Rambam's approach of incorporating back the principles to what's going on behind the scenes. So he didn't just, remember the tour and the his ordering was just be practical, matter of fact, and it walks you through from the morning you wake up, the minute you wake up, the minute you go to sleep tonight, and so on, as opposed to the Rambam. So the Mishnah Berurah goes through in that order, commenting line by line, word by word, going through the Shulchan Aruch, both including the Mechaber and the Rama. But he attempts to make it practical for his day and age, we call it the year 1900 and so. And also he attempts, whenever, as much as he could, to bring back the principles, like the Rambam style approach. So that's what we have in front of us today. We're going to learn, Bez Hashem, the Mishnah Berurah. So we'll learn it reading the Shulchan Aruch inside, Mechaber Rama, every word, and he then goes line by line, piece by piece. I'm sure you've learned all before at some point. You know how it works. Looking for time. Fine, so let me just, we'll do this for a minute more, just the basic geography on the page, so tomorrow we can start in earnest. May I just borrow anyone's? There's a new version of the Mishnah Berurah that's come out, which has like the Mishnah Berurah in the middle, then like, sorry, the Shulchan Aruch in the middle and the Mishnah Berurah going around, like it's the Rama. Very interesting. Which is actually much easier to use, I think, but in any case, I'm not using one. This is the structure, if you can see. On top is the Shulchan Aruch. Usually in bold prints, you'll have the Mechaber, and in the Rashi script, the lighter print, is the Rama. Okay? Then the Mishnah Berurah is the main commentary, it's usually the largest on the bottom here. On the inside is the Mishnah Berurah. On the outside, if you will, is another work also by the same author. It's an accompaniment to Mishnah Berurah called the Be'er Hetzev, which means, I don't know, clear explanation. Also, Be'er Halacha, I'm sorry. Correction, yeah. Sorry, Be'er Halacha. The Be'er Halacha is the clarification of the Halacha. literally, I mean. So he basically takes particular more thorny issues and deals them more fully. I do not intend to read the Bir Halachos to you inside. From time to time, I mean, I'll learn them and I'll bring the issue in and I'll bottom line it. And like, the second Bir Halacha I'm talking about, I'll have to deal with inside. There are a few critical ones that I wouldn't leave out, but in general, we're leaving it on the loan for extra curricular activity. There's also, at the bottom, there's another word called the Shari Tzion, which means the gates of citations, I guess, whatever, which is essentially his footnotes. So there's some commentary there, but basically it's just essentially citations that the Mishnah Berurah had. And the top half here, if you will, that's the bottom half. The top half are two other works which precede the Mishnah Berurah and are very important. The first is the Ber Hetev. I love the Ber Hetev. If it went up to me, I'd have done a Ber Hetev shir. I wouldn't have done a Mishnah Berurah shir, but no one would have come, so we're not doing the Ber Hetev shir. Okay? Ber Hetev is actually, I think, written by two different people, depending on which part of Shulchan Aruch you're talking about. But he was, we'll call him the first Mishnah Berurah, if you will, okay? Ber Hetev is, he went through, bottom line, things like the Mishnah Berurah does, and collected from the notes of Caleb and the Shulchan Aruch. It's a great, great, great work. And if you want a shortcut, if a person is serious about getting to the background of the halacha but doesn't want to deal with the Beis Yosef, if you'd ask me, I'll just say learn the Ber Hetev and follow his citations. So the Ber Hetev brings every relevant shach, every relevant taz, every relevant Magen Avraham. He's like, he's great with the Ber Hetev, but again, I won't look at him inside. I'll just read it myself, and if something relevant, I'll bring it to you. And then the Shari Tshuva deals with tshuvas, essentially. They're like, you know, practical matters. Now, I'm not going to look at the Shari Tshuva. I probably didn't really study Shari Tshuva very much in preparation for the course, to be honest, the class. There are other more modern Shuvas farm I'll look at, which deal with real practical halacha. In any case, that's the structure, that's the plan, and tomorrow, Bez Hashem, we will begin with Simon Aleph and go through Mishnah Berurah. Okay.